UIC Business Graduate School. UIC is ranked number 7 on the Wall Street Journal's list of best value universities. An open house is January 26th. More at go.uic.edu/gradhouse.
Benazir played matchmaker, introducing two fellow Oxford students, a certain Philip May and Teresa Brazier. So after they were married, that would make her...
I have just been to Buckingham Palace, where Her Majesty the Queen has asked me to form a new government, and I accepted.
British Prime Minister Theresa May. Benazir Bhutto always dined at the top table. But through her family, she also claimed a connection to Pakistan's poor.
I was taught from a very early age to understand their suffering because my father would talk to us about the problems that our people faced. Even when I went to Harvard, his words to me were that you are going abroad to study, but remember that the foreign exchange, which will subsidize your education, comes from the sweat and the blood of the peasants who toil our lands, and therefore you must return and serve the people and repay this debt that you owe to them.
But in Pakistan, privilege is precarious. In 1977, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto ran into Pakistan's power-hungry army. There had, by this point, already been two military rulers in Pakistan's short history. Acutely aware of the risk of another coup, Bhutto had appointed as army chief a little-known general called Zia-ul-Haq. Benazir's father calculated that the conservative, middle-class Zia lacked the confidence and the power base to challenge him. He was wrong.
The armed forces of Pakistan have taken over the administration of the country this morning.
Zia launched a coup and threw Zulfikar Ali Bhutto in jail.
Top political leaders, including the former Prime Minister, Mr. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, have been taken into temporary protective custody.
General Zia had more surprises. Normally, Pakistan's ousted leaders are allowed to live in exile. General Zia had different ideas. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was tried, convicted, and sentenced.
This is Radio Pakistan. The news. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was hanged to death at 2 o'clock this morning in Rawalpindi District Jail.
General Zia-ul-Haq had no qualms.
I am of the opinion that the higher you go, the harder you fall. I have a very strong conviction and feeling that I've done the right thing and I've done what is good in the interest of Pakistan.
But the military man failed to appreciate the implications of what he had done. By hanging Bhutto, he had created that most powerful of political symbols in Pakistan, a martyr. The BBC's Mark Tully reported it all.
Mr. Bhutto's last words before he was hanged in the early hours of the morning were, "Lord help me, I am innocent." His body was then rushed to the Rawalpindi Air Force Base in an army lorry. From there it was flown by plane and then helicopter to the small hamlet of Gari Bhutto, his family home. Mr. Bhutto's first wife said she saw his face. She described it as innocent as a flower. His second wife and daughter, who are being held in custody near Rawalpindi, were not allowed to attend the funeral.
So in 1979, at the age of just 25, Benazir stepped into the spotlight and took the helm of her father's Pakistan People's Party, or PPP. She was certainly non-violent, but she was hardly passive. Rhetorically, she took the fight to the man who had deposed and then hanged her father.
Every step with General Zia-ul-Haq has taken from July 5th, 1977 has been a link in the ugly chain of crush Bhutto, crush PPP, crush political parties, ensure that there is no democratic institution which survives.
Benazir was emerging as a formidable opponent of General Zia. But then he got a lucky break. On Christmas Day, 1979, Soviet troops invaded Afghanistan. At a stroke, General Zia became a key Western ally.
Soviet Union is a superpower which now has a very great regional influence in our area.
Pakistan had just become a frontline state in the Cold War. The US began to send money and weapons through Pakistan to Muslim men, the Mujahideen, willing to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. Benazir Bhutto warned against it. A leaked cable from the US embassy in Islamabad at the time noted Benazir's fear that the situation in Afghanistan could, in her words, be disastrous for Pakistan. She would, it must be said, be proven right. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the American and Saudi response created a generation of violent jihadists, and in time, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. You could draw a line from the Soviet invasion to the Talibanization of Pakistan and the influx of drugs, Kalashnikovs and Afghan refugees. In other words, the Cold War unleashed forces which would have a defining role not just for Pakistan, but for Benazir Bhutto personally. Even the most independent Pakistani woman needs a husband. Pakistan, after all, is a strong patriarchy. Benazir might have been a romantic, but few men were willing to date her. Family friend Javed Jabbar.
Most men who might otherwise have been eligible for her attention were themselves greatly inhibited by the stature of the person and all the baggage that she carried.
So, a marriage was arranged with a man from a minor landowning family. His name, Asif Ali Zardari. I talked to him about meeting Benazir.
How many times did you meet her before you married her?
Once we were introduced in Karachi, and then we met for about a week, what is called the, in an art of terminology, escorting period, where all the aunts and the uncles and everybody else goes out with you, and you're allowed to, you know, look at each other, talk to each other, but never be alone. And we were engaged.
And it changed your life?
And it spun my life. Not just changed my life, it spun my life.
In 1988, a year after the nuptials, Zia ul Haq died in a plane crash. For Benazir Bhutto, it was a huge relief.
It wasn't just, you know, the fact that he executed my father, but throughout the long years of his rule, we always lived under the shadow of death. Not only my family, but other members of the party and those who are committed to democracy. We never knew from day to day what would happen. And suddenly, it just seemed so unbelievable that this entire shadow of death and threat that we had lived under, that is actually gone.
And when it was announced there would be elections, Benazir's path to power was clear. She ran and she won. 4 months later, she was the Muslim world's first female prime minister. Javed Jabbar served in her first cabinet and says she was literally full of surprises.
To carry a child, to be pregnant, and to keep it a secret, a super state secret, which none of us in cabinet virtually knew, that this prime minister of ours is about to deliver a baby. And then, lo and behold, suddenly we learn that she has gone and not only delivered democracy, she's also delivered a baby.
As prime minister, Benazir was now in a position to advance her ideals, many inherited from her father. But she faced multiple problems. The military, aware of her rage about her father's death, never trusted her. And the Soviets had been driven from Afghanistan, which meant thousands of radicalized Islamist fighters had time on their hands. and some of them began to plot to kill her. I've seen documents detailing two assassination attempts from this period in her life, more than a decade before they tried to kill her in Karachi. They're accounts of federal police investigations, and they say that in 1993, a hit team tried to plant a bomb in a sewer outside Benazir's family home. They knew she'd pass over it on her way to visit her mother. The assassins were at the sewer when a police officer asked them what they were up to. "Looking for my spectacles," one said. "I've dropped them down the drain." The officer told them to move on, and they did. Fearing they'd be recognized if they returned, they hatched a new plan. Hire a former army sniper to shoot Benazir at a rally. They got the gun, they scoped the spot, it was all set to go, but the shooter couldn't get there on time. If Benazir were a cat, she'd now used two lives. Enemies soon identified Benazir's weak point, money, and it would have a huge bearing on how her life would play out. She and her husband, Asif Zardari, were hit with a string of corruption charges. He became widely known as Mr. 10% for allegedly taking kickbacks. He denied it and said it was just mudslinging.
And they were always trying to make me into the bad guy, to cut her down.
He was never convicted, but he did spend years in prison.
It's not easy to spend 12 years in solitary confinement, but it's the cause. I gave my youth, and they used to send me all sorts of messages that, you know, we've managed to finish Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, we'll finish you, we'll finish your children. But one just took it with a pinch of salt.
When Asif Zardari was in prison in 1998, he was let out for a court hearing in Lahore, which Benazir Bhutto attended. So did I. I was covering it for the BBC. As the day progressed, I realized they'd probably be flying back together on the PIA flight from Lahore to Islamabad. And I figured that even if he had handcuffs and a phalanx of guards, they'd find a way to go first class. I bought a first class ticket too, not in the least bit confident that the BBC would pay for it. But it worked a treat. I ended up in the row behind them and had a good chat about the case. Then they said they needed to talk and spent the rest of the flight whispering to each other. I had two observations. First, they seemed genuinely fond of each other. Secondly, they had an awful lot to talk about. But that shouldn't have been a surprise. In 1999, a Pakistani court found Benazir guilty of taking kickbacks on government contracts while Prime Minister. They faced the prospect of both being in prison. And that, Zardari told me, was not an option.
If one has to go to prison, then it has to be me. It was sort of a family cardinal rule we'd made between ourselves, because if they arrest me, they can't arrest her also.
Zardari did return to prison, and in 1999, Benazir left the country. Here began her long self-imposed exile. She steadfastly denied the corruption charges against her and campaigned for them to be dropped so she could return safely to Pakistan.
Thank you so much.
September 2007, Capitol Hill, Washington, D.C.
When the history of my nation is written, I think we will look back to the fall of 2007 as a genuine turning point in Pakistan.
Pakistan was ruled at the time by General Pervez Musharraf. He had taken power in a coup, and Washington backed him.
General Musharraf has tried convincing the world that he is the only one standing in the way of an extremist takeover of nuclear-armed Pakistan. In fact, military rule is the cause of the anarchic situation in Pakistan.
now she wanted Washington's backing. The speech was the centerpiece of a huge lobbying effort organized by a man standing on the sidelines that day, Mark Siegel.
I was a close friend. I had worked as her lobbyist and spokesman in Washington. I had insisted that she come to America before she went back to Pakistan to meet very publicly with U.S. government officials and the media as basically as an insurance policy, thinking that they wouldn't dare to hurt her if she was very high profile and demonstrated her support.
Benazir was worried about enemies inside and outside the government in Pakistan. After 9/11, the U.S. bankrolled Pakistan's army. Now Benazir was saying, careful, these generals have a hidden agenda.
Retired military officers from the security forces, the very ones who recruited the Afghan Mujahideen, who later morphed into the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, are today in charge of our homeland security.
Benazir was playing with fire. Behind the scenes, she'd been leveraging her support in the West to pressurize Musharraf to drop the corruption charges which had sent her into exile. Benazir now wanted to go home. The deal was, dismiss the charges and I'll come back after the upcoming elections. And now she was saying from Washington, with all the symbolism that carried, I'll be returning before the elections so that I can contest them.
I plan to return to Pakistan next month. I do not know what awaits me once I leave the airport.
American journalist Ron Susskind was with Benazir as she went on the lobbying tour of Capitol Hill.
She was full of trepidation. She says, look, this could be very dangerous. And she was going around the halls of the Senate looking for support, security support, some sort of protection, whether official or unofficial protection, whether it's a Blackwater-style unit.
Blackwater, the American private security firm.
Or something official inside of the U.S. intelligence and security apparatus to help protect her when she returned to Karachi.
Benazir reached out to Congressman Tom Lantos, who was head of the powerful Foreign Relations Committee. Maybe he could help with her security.
I set up the Lantos meeting and brought her to Lantos's office.
Mark Siegel.
He was delayed. His wife took us into his office and sat with us and chatted.
And then the phone rang.
Her cell phone rang. She looked down at the phone as if she was reading a phone number and looked back up at me and mouthed the words, Musharraf.
Mark Siegel jumped up and led Benazir to a little room off the congressman's main office. She closed the door behind her.
She was alone for the length of that call, which was 6 or 7 or maybe as much as 10 minutes, but it was not a 90-second call. And when she returned, when she opened the door, I could see that she was visibly upset. You know, Benazir was a very strong woman, and it takes a lot to shake her, considering the life that she lived, but she was very, very shaken.
Benazir Bhutto told her old friend Siegel about the call.
She said, he threatened me. He told me not to come back. He warned me not to come back. He said he will not be responsible for what's going to happen to me if he comes back. And that he said that her safety, her security, was a function of her relationship with him.
But she took it really as a threat.
Absolutely.
You could see if she was upset.
The next person she told was reporter Ron Susskind, who met her outside the congressman's office.
She was different walking in and walking out, in kind of ways that would be hard to fake. Something you learn over years watching people and their reactions, especially to very bad news.
And this is how he remembers Benazir's account of the call from General Pervez Musharraf.
Look, Perez, it could be trouble. You know, do I have your assurance that you will protect me? And Musharraf laughs on the phone and says, your security, your safety is based on the nature of our relationship. Utterly conditional and at my discretion.
those last two parts I'm saying. The nature of our relationship. And Bhutto goes flush. And she says, are you saying what I think you're saying? And that was the phone call. She hangs up the phone and she is unglued, saying essentially, Ms. Sharif just threatened me and said that I am at risk, and whether or not that risk turns into tragic outcome is his decision.
She came from that meeting, and the first thing she said was, you won't believe what just happened.
Rattled, Benazir left Capitol Hill to meet another old friend, Pakistan's former ambassador to the United States, Hussain Haqqani.
So it was within an hour of that conversation.
So that's very interesting, because she'd immediately told Mark Siegel, she then told Ron Susskind, both on Capitol Hill with her, and she then goes for a meal with you and repeats it.
Yes, she said the same thing, so it's sequential. I hadn't seen Ron or Mark at that point. I was seeing her independently. And she walked in, and the first thing she said was, Haqqani Saab, you won't believe what just happened. And then she described the conversation.
And used this phrase about her security?
Absolutely. It was the same phrase. She said, Musharraf just told me, on my return, my security will totally depend on my relationship with him.
We've spent a lot of time on this call because it's going to matter in next week's program when General Musharraf tells me it never happened. Whatever the truth of that, those who wanted Benazir dead were continuing to plot. Next time, they find their mark. You can hear the next episode of The Assassination at the same time next week. But the whole series is already available as a podcast. I do recommend them. They go into even more depth than what we've been able to do here.
You're listening to 91.5 FM WBEZ and WBEZ.org.
This week on Nerd App Podcast, we want to help you get your money life in order, because it turns out money goals are very closely related to life goals.
Money and money management can feel really abstract. And so bringing it into your life and seeing how that money can get you what you want, it is really empowering.
That's this week on Nerd App. Listen to Nerd App for free wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the BBC World Service on WBEZ HD Chicago 91.5 FM, WBEQ HD Morris 90.7 FM, WBEK Kankakee 91.1 FM, and WBEZ.org.
Hello and welcome to Newsday on the BBC World Service with me, Carney Sharp, in the Newsday here, and Lawrence Pollard outside the Houses of Parliament for us.
In the Newsday tent, it's the morning after the biggest defeat in British parliamentary history. Theresa May, the Prime Minister, failed to get support in thumping style for her Brexit deal. Well over 200 votes.
Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
Claudia Rankine says that every conversation about race doesn't need to be about racism. And she's revelatory for me as a white American about pain points that are woven into the fabric of the American everyday. She models how it's possible to bring this out into the open, not in order to fight, but in order to draw closer. She shows how we can all do this, hour by hour, encounter by encounter, in ordinary times and spaces.
And I spend a lot of time thinking about how can I say this so that we can stay in this car together and yet explore the things that I want to explore with you.
I just think that line,
how can I say this so we can stay in this car together?
It's like it should be a national motto for us.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Claudia Rankine's book, Citizen, an American Lyric, was a New York Times bestseller and won many awards. She teaches at Yale and is also the founder of the Racial Imaginary Institute. And she's published several collections of poetry and also plays. She joined me at the Kay Playhouse at Hunter College in New York City. We were there as part of the 2018 Work It Women's Podcast Festival.
Hello, New York City. Just before I start, I just want to say how fabulous it is to be here. And I've wanted to interview Claudia forever, and I've just kind of been waiting for the right moment, and this was it. And here we all are together for it. And I want to thank Melissa LaCase and WNYC, and especially the great people at WNYC Studios. So you were born in Jamaica and came to the U.S. when you were seven, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. And somewhere when you were describing the that time of your birth, you put it in context this way, that 11 days after you were born on September 15th, 1963, four black girls were killed in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. So you were still in Jamaica those first 7 years of your life, and I wonder, did you know that did you have that context, or was that sequence something that you learned later when you were in the States?
I didn't know. I can't even say if my parents knew, but what they did know is that wasn't a surprise. So that when we came to the United States, my mother said, she had two things that she believed in any case. One was that public school was awful, and she did say this to me, you cannot trust white people. Those were her two, as a Jamaican woman coming to the United States in the 1960s when the American government opened up immigration because of a need for healthcare workers. Yeah. So that brought a kind of flood from the Caribbean. Yeah.
And previous.
Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
Claudia Rankine says that every conversation about race doesn't need to be about racism. And she's revelatory for me as a white American about pain points that are woven into the fabric of the American everyday. She models how it's possible to bring this out into the open, not in order to fight, but in order to draw closer. She shows how we can all do this, hour by hour, encounter by encounter, in ordinary times and spaces.
And I spend a lot of time thinking about how can I say this so that we can stay in this car together and yet explore the things that I want to explore with you?
I just think that line,
how can I say this so we can stay in this car together?
It should be a national motto for us.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Claudia Rankine's book, Citizen, an American Lyric, was a New York Times bestseller and won many awards. She teaches at Yale and is also the founder of the Racial Imaginary Institute. And she's published several collections of poetry and also plays. She joined me at the Kay Playhouse at Hunter College in New York City. We were there as part of the 2018 Work It Women's Podcast Festival.
Hello, New York City. Just before I start, I wanted... Well, first, I just want to say how fabulous it is to be here. And I've wanted to interview Claudia forever, and I've just kind of been waiting for the right moment, and this was it. And here we all are together for it. And I want to thank Melissa LaCase and WNYC, and especially the great people at WNYC Studios. So you were born in Jamaica and came to the U.S. when you were seven, is that right?
That's correct,
okay. And somewhere, when you were describing that time of your birth, you put it in context this way, that 11 days after you were born, on September 15th, 1963, four black girls were killed in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. So you were still in Jamaica those first 7 years of your life, and I wonder... did you know that did you have that context, or was that sequence something that you learned later when you were in the States?
I didn't know. I can't even say if my parents knew. But what they did know is that wasn't a surprise. Mm-hmm. So that when we came to the United States, my mother said she had two things that she believed in any case. One was that public school was awful, and she did say this to me, you cannot trust white people. Those were her two, as a Jamaican woman coming to the United States in the 1960s when the American government opened up immigration because of a need for healthcare workers. Yeah. So that's brought a kind of flood from the Caribbean. Yeah.
And previously, most immigrants had been white Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly. So, so whether or not she knew exactly that, she knew it,
mm-hmm.
and she communicated it.
Was there a religious background to your childhood?
My mother's religious in any way you can be religious. She goes to church, she reads the Bible, she quotes the Bible, she invokes the Bible. So we grew up with a real sense of her going to church.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't always go because I didn't want my hair straightened. And if I wouldn't straighten my hair, she wasn't going to take me, so of course what?
Yeah,
so there was
great.
No straightening of the hair.
That's true. One of the main things I remember about going to church growing up was dressing up for Easter.
Exactly.
Which is really not what we're supposed to be remembering.
Well, that's, it became a kind of a moment to be public in all your beauty, whatever your sense of that is.
Yeah. You published Citizen, was 2014, right? It's funny, I thought it was more recent. And to your point, 2014 feels like about 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a different world, although in my mind, one of the characteristics of the world of 2014 as opposed to now is that it was easier to pretend that we had made more progress than we have. For some of us. Not, right? So, because so there were realities,
yeah.
And there were realities, and it was possible
mm-hmm.
to not know or to not say that you could see that.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that one thing you were doing in Citizen, so, you said your mother would always speak of American blacks and American whites. She had this clarity that there were different realities and experiences, and that you were kind of... laying out, documenting, giving voice to the cumulative imprint of those distinct realities and experiences. And it was in ordinary time, in the subway, outside your therapist's office, on an airplane, at lunch at a college you're speaking at, in your child's school, in a real estate showing, on and on and on. You write about this exhaustion of constantly not just having the experience, but asking yourself, did he say that? Did I hear that? Did she mean that? Is this racism or not?
I think in the years coming up to the publication of Citizen, I was interested in this idea that we had entered a new time. And yet I was seeing the ways that racism, we know about structural racism, we understand, you know, what, how it goes top down institutionally, structurally. But when you understand that it's coming from your friends, mm-hmm. you know, your so-called friends, and it's coming from your colleagues, and it's so unmarked. So the writing of Citizen was really a project in, like, how do you get language to mark the unmarked? Mm-hmm. Because clearly, I mean, I believe these people are my friends. I mean, I spent a lot of time with them. I, you know, and in good faith, I'm working with my colleagues, or I'm trusting, you know, every time you drive your car, you're trusting everybody around you. And yet, I was still feeling assaulted and diminished mm-hmm. and insulted. And, you know, you say that anger is how pain shows itself in public.
Yeah.
And angry. You know, so I really wanted to see how do you get language to show that. And the examples in Citizens aren't, some of them are mine, but they're not, most, for the most part, they're not mine intentionally, because I didn't want people to say, you know, you should get new friends.
Right.
Or you should make better choices with who you hang out with. And so I called other friends who are, for the most part, African-American, and said, can you tell me something, some ordinary thing that you were doing? And then somebody in your life said or did something to make you realize in their eyes you are no one. And so many of those came, and they wouldn't come right away. People would say, oh, I don't know, I can't really think of anything. And then they would call back. And then the stories would pour out mm-hmm. to the point, I remember I asked a friend who's a lawyer in Los Angeles, and he's this, you know, he's this guy who is like, he's the definition of cool. You know, like he's the one, if all the kids are in the house together and his family's there and our family and Andre's family, and, you know, some fire starts, and the rest of us are like, oh my God. He's like, put it out. You know, he's that guy. He's right, put it out. And when he came over, I said, I'll make you dinner. You come over and you tell me everything that's ever happened to you. And that's what happened. And he came over, and he turned into a different person. He cried at our dining room table. His wife, who's white, had never heard any of these stories. And she completely changed after that dinner. So it was a sobering exercise in terms of the gathering of those pieces in Citizen.
I wonder, let's see, this one. Because I think we're talking kind of in the abstract if people haven't read the book. Here, just this one, page 7, which is also kind of the effect it has on you.
Certain moments send adrenaline to the heart, dry out the tongue, and clog the lungs. Like thunder, they drown you in sound. No, like lightning, they strike you across the larynx. Cough. After it happened, I was at a loss for words. Haven't you said this yourself? Haven't you said this to a close friend who early in your friendship, when distracted, would call you by the name of her black housekeeper? You assumed you two were the only black people in her life. Eventually, she stopped doing this, though she never acknowledged her slippage. And you never called her on it. Why not? And yet, you don't forget. If this were a domestic tragedy, and it might as well be, this would be your fatal flaw, your memory, vessel of your feelings. Do you feel hurt because it's the all black people look the same moment, or because you're being confused with another after being so close to this other? Thank you. That last line, I have to say, was the hardest line to write in the book, because the original version of that piece was something like, I was trying too hard to come up with the language of in my head. So I was thinking, is it because she's a servant? And I would go on hikes and think, okay, come on. What is it? And then I realized it really is about intimacy. You know, you really, when it comes down to it, the space between us gets violated in these moments. And you get othered.
Right. Where you don't expect to be othered.
Where you don't expect to be othered.
Tippett, and this is On Being, today with poet, essayist, and playwright Claudia Rankine. In our project, when we're talking about race, always being attentive to wanting to soften the space for people to hear. You know, we won't let, like language of white privilege or white supremacy, you can talk about it without using the words. And that, I think, is important, because some of these words, like the word racist, trigger all these reactions in people, and you know, shut their imaginations down and get them, and so they stop listening. I mean, and the language of white supremacy now is so loaded in all kinds of other ways, right? And now we think of very real forced energies and people who are hate mongers, vigilantes. But I feel like what you also give voice to and put words around is kind of, I don't know if this is the right language, but like the soft underbelly of white supremacy that is really about all of us, our culture, that's in... Well, just in this fact that, as you point this out, white Americans don't identify as white Americans, they just identify as Americans. It's, you mentioned like Hannah Arendt and the banality of evil, that notion. And I think we all, a lot of us who are educated, know that, but I don't think white Americans ever apply that image to how we live. And this, what you're describing, going through your days, is experiencing the banality of evil. And it is white supremacy as it is woven into the fabric of everyday life.
Bernie Sanders, who said the fact that in Florida and Georgia, that white Americans couldn't get themselves to vote, they're not racist, they just couldn't get themselves to vote for a black person. Now, if that is not the definition of racism, I don't know what is. And Bernie Sanders puts himself, was presented as...
Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
Claudia Rankine says that every conversation about race doesn't need to be about racism. And she's revelatory for me as a white American,
about pain points that are woven into the fabric of the American everyday. She models how it's possible to bring this out into the open, not in order to fight, but in order to draw closer. She shows how we can all do this, hour by hour, encounter by encounter, in ordinary times and spaces.
And I spend a lot of time thinking about how can I say this so that we can stay in this car together and yet explore the things that I want to explore with you.
I just think that line, how can
I say this so we can stay
in this car together? It's like, it should be a national motto.